Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. As we get started this morning, not only have we officially crossed the threshold of 100,000 Americans who've died from the coronavirus, but the president actually put out a tweet expressing sympathy for them, something he has not done so far. And meanwhile, we're getting these scary pictures out of Minneapolis, burning and looting in the wake of the police action that resulted in the death of a black man. It's threatening, unfortunately, to overshadow some of those larger issues there. But you know how that's going to play out in our political divisions. We got more bad jobs numbers. More than 40 million jobless claims have been filed in just 10 weeks. The president is promising that he is going to be issuing an executive order targeting social media. What that actually means is unclear. Some of the key protections for social media, like Section 230, cannot be rescinded by executive order. That takes regulations. And then there is that whole First Amendment thing. So joining us today, because there's so much going on, there's new polls out, there's developments by the hour, is our good friend A.B. Stoddard from Real Clear Politics. Good to have you back, A.B.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
Do your friends call you A.B.?
It depends.
Okay.
My name is Alexandra. It's a long story.
Okay, so we'll call you A.B. then, okay?
Okay.
All right. So I want to start off with a personal thing, which is actually not that personal. It's what Rush Limbaugh did yesterday. And when I say personal, it's because I used to do a talk radio show for 26 years. And so I think I understand talk radio. And I always tried to distinguish myself from some of the things that he did. I mean, I'll be honest about it. I mean, you know, Rush Limbaugh created the genre of conservative talk radio. There's no way. I mean, historically, the impact that he has had on conservative media has been tremendous. But also, if you really want to track the decadence of conservative talk radio, you can't do better than to watch what's happened with Rush Limbaugh. And yesterday... And I'm really trying to be delicate about this because you know that he's sick. He's very sick. He's making no secret of the fact that he has cancer and that the treatments are, I think he said, kicking his ass. And so you want to be sensitive about that. But I guess part of me is wondering, you know, if at that point in life, don't people think about their legacy? I mean, doesn't a normal person think about, okay, who at the end of the day am I? What have I done? How do I want to be remembered? Isn't that the way most people think about these things?
Yeah, I really thought that his disclosure about that, his big moment at the State of the Union, when it was brought to the attention of everyone in the country, even those who don't listen to Rush Limbaugh or any talk radio, the telling of his story, the look in his eyes, I mean, it did bring home the grappling that you do when you face a potentially fatal illness about your whole life, the sum of your life, whether you're famous or not and going to have a legacy or not, about what's important and what you value and what it means to be human. Yeah. And it is really strange to me that he hasn't found some light in terms of delighting in human cruelty, which is what he was talking about the president doing.
Well, that's the heart of it. So he's talking about, he finally weighs in on the president pushing this debunked conspiracy theory about Joe Scarborough committing, you know, murder. And, you know, the president continues to ignore the pleas from the woman's husband, other people. There are a lot of people who have been reliable allies of Trump who clearly are appalled by just the pure cruelty of this. But then Rush Limbaugh goes and devotes a big chunk of his show to explain that it's all about the fun of triggering folks who care about morality. So, you know, the lie doesn't matter. The moralizing is a joke. Cruelty is cleverness. And we just don't appreciate the clever subtlety of Donald Trump. So let me just play this. I'm going to 2 minutes because I think it really captures, what I described on Twitter yesterday is the sophistry, not just of Rush Limbaugh, but really a lot of what's happened to the conservative media. And then as I mentioned, because I used to be part of this, it didn't have to be this way. But let's just play this and then and let's talk about what Rush Limbaugh basically going into the breach to defend Trump on Joe Scarborough. Let's play it.
When you get to Trump and his conspiracy theories, he does it in a really clever way. And this is where people don't get the subtlety of Trump because they don't think he has the ability to be subtle. Trump never says that he believes these conspiracy theories that he touts. He simply passed them on. Like during the campaign of 2016, I ran the gamut of emotions on this. When Trump said that he had seen a picture of Ted Cruz's dad standing next to Lee Harvey Oswald. And I said, what the hell is this? And I thought, he's going to have to walk this back. Ted Cruz's dad had something to do with the assassination of JFK. He never walked it back. But more importantly, he never asserted it himself. He simply said it was out there and that people ought to know. And with virtually every conspiracy theory that Trump touts, he doesn't actually tout them himself. He spreads them, and he under the guise, people need to know about this. And it's his way of jamming them up. It's his way of teasing them. It's his way of getting these conspiracy theories out there. For example, as a way of illustrating, do you think, Mr. Snerdley, do you think Trump cares whether Scarborough murdered anybody or not? No, of course he doesn't care. So why is he tweeting it? Well, because it's out there. He didn't make it up. It's long been out there that this death has something suspicious about it. So Trump is just throwing gasoline on a fire here. And he's having fun watching the flames. And he's having fun watching these holier-than-thou leftist journalists react like their moral sensibilities have been forever rocked and can never recover.
Wow. So, A.B. Stoddard.
I think it's important to tell people who have tried to not pay attention to this revolting episode that among the holier-than-thou leftist journalists that he's mocking are the New York Post editorial page, the Washington Examiner editorial page, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, all basically calling this vile and inexcusable and grist for people to completely conclude that Trump is unfit to be president, lead us through this crisis. Rush's attempt to normalize this, if you just step back and think about what you used to do in talk radio, Charlie, which is you take the best arguments for your side and you try to convince the listeners there's a good reason to be on that side, not you try to twist their minds into accepting this, really actually flagrantly making the case that your side has gone over the edge and is twisted into some kind of sickness. And his play to make this five-dimensional chess with a clever act of subtlety,
yes,
because he doesn't believe the theories, is laughable. And again, something that Rush could have easily ignored, made a passing comment on, dismissed, or he could have joined with the other voices saying, you want to lose to Joe Biden? Keep this up.
Yeah, he had a choice. This was not required. One of the things that's just struck me is that whole thing about, you know, people don't appreciate Donald Trump's subtlety. I mean, I wrote this morning, there are a lot of mountains that Rush could choose to die on, but the subtlety of Donald Trump. But you're right. you have this whole thing here where it's the cynicism, this four-dimensional chess, these pretzeled rationalizations, you know, the hint that he's letting his audience in on some clever secret knowledge of what's really doing. And of course, the fun of watching people moralize, you know, nothing matters. So again, what you have here is the lies don't matter. Moralizing is a joke. Cruelty is cleverness. And you go, wow, you know, is this really what we've become? And I think that, you know, maybe it's unfair to pick too much on Rush Limbaugh, because this is kind of a capsulization of a lot of what's happened on the conservative media. this whole, it's all about the lulls. You know, we just throw stuff out. And but I thought it was interesting the way he's arguing that, well, Trump doesn't actually tout the stuff that he's touting when he's not really spreading what he's spreading, these distinctions without a difference. And, you know, again, a part of it is this what Rush Limbaugh wants to do for himself? But, you know, I don't know.
I just think that there's been a few voices that you and I listen to, and I think your audience listens to for a while now, saying that people have invested so much in the bad bet of Trump, they'll behave as desperately and as fraudulently as he does on the way down the tunnel, scratching the sides with fingernails to try to keep some traction. And we don't know that this will end on November 3rd. We really don't, because, you know, circumstances can change. But there's a sense now that they're in free fall, that he's so self-destructive, he won't listen to, you know, his new campaign advisors like Dave Bossie and Corey Lewandowski, who are telling him he has to do something to change this trajectory, like he could change what he did on COVID, right? And all this other stuff. And so the people around him supporting him, if you watch them on Twitter and you hear what you're saying, are sounding more ridiculous than they did in 2017, 18, or 19, because they sense that they made the bad bet and they have to find a way to keep it going rather than jump ship.
Yeah, it's, there's a lot of sunken costs there. I've mentioned this before, by the way, and for longtime listeners of the Bulwark podcast, you've heard me quote Hannah Arendt before. Our friend Windsor Mann actually pointed this out again. You know, when Hannah Arendt described the culture of the, you know, mass propaganda machines, she had a really interesting insight about the cynicism and the gullibility. She basically said, you know, not basically, this is what she wrote. Mass propaganda discovered that its audience was ready at all times to believe the worst, no matter how absurd, and did not particularly object to being deceived because it held every statement to be a lie anyhow. And there's one little paragraph that just seems to, Rush Limbaugh seems to be like a caricature of this. The totalitarian mass leaders base their propaganda on the correct psychological assumption that under such conditions, one could make people believe the most fantastic statements one day and trust that if the next day they were given irrefutable proof of their falsehood, they would take refuge in cynicism. Instead of deserting the leaders who had lied to them, they would protest they had known all along the statement was a lie and would admire the leaders for their superior tactical cleverness. And that's, isn't that what Rush Limbaugh goes? Okay, yeah, he's lying. He's just bullshitting, but you know, he's clever. He's tactical. Okay, it's, you know, it's cruel, but don't you understand how funny it is to watch people reacting to the cruelty?
And that's the fuel behind tribalism, is that you don't seek what's true or right or correct or productive or moral or anything. It's all just to get one over on another group of people.
Correct. Okay, let's, all right, let's just move on to what things are going on right now. I did have the feeling this morning that just when you thought America could not become more divided, we see these images out of Minneapolis and out of Los Angeles of the burning and the looting, and you know the way that will be used as a wedge to further divide the country. And you're already seeing that. And, you know, quite frankly, I think people should not underestimate the potential political potency of images like that. If you want to write any sort of a history of the rise of the right, the exploitation of law and order, go back to look what happened in the late 1960s and the 1970s. Some of the backlash to things that happened involving, you know, police actions also, I think, have contributed to the tribalization. I mean, I think this is just a reality. And I think if you turn on Fox News last night, you see that this is going to be a big storyline threatening to overshadow the issue that we had been grappling with, which is police violence.
Right. There's no question. The only heartening thing that I saw in the last 24 hours was some response from some law enforcement leaders basically saying, you know, this is unacceptable. In graphic terms, you know, you don't put your body weight on someone's neck for 9 minutes unless you intend to murder them. And if you can't do your job, you don't believe that that's wrong, you shouldn't be a police officer. That's the kind of thing that is actually, unfortunately and sadly, a breakthrough compared to years and years and years before this, when they stood by mostly silent and let society debate this. So I think that increasingly we're going to need to hear from people in law enforcement try to cut through the political and the culture wars over this. But it is a very power. They're very powerful images. They're very upsetting images. It's a very good narrative to inflate, discuss, spotlight, highlight, and it's an incredibly effective distraction from 100,000 deaths or anything else, including this man's death, that Trump would like to avoid discussing.
So let's talk about the state of play. You have a piece up on Real Clear Politics about the Senate. Is the anxiety seems to be spreading that Trump is endangering everything, and yet within the last 2 weeks we read one account after another of Republican members of the Senate saying, "Yeah, we are completely all in. We are. There's not going to be any criticism. There's not going to be any pushback. We're going to go. We're going to sink or swim with Donald Trump." Is that the mood right now?
Yeah. So we saw a couple weeks ago when the NRSC, the Senate Committee for Republicans, put out a 57-page memo detailing good strategies for Senate Republicans in cycle. And it basically bluntly said, do not defend Trump on the pandemic response, just attack China. And within days, the Trump universe fought back and the NRSC had to retreat. And the senators pretended they never saw the memo and everything's hunky-dory. And then people like Senator Thune, who's in leadership, went on the record saying we've pretty much concluded our fortunes rise and fall with the president. But they say that in, you know, in resignation and in defeat. I mean, they are they understand how toxic these investigations are, that he's pushing them to start. There's a reason that Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham wanted to talk about them, but never do them until now. Now they are doing them for him because they know that that's the worst thing an incumbent Republican senator in a contested race should be talking about this year. It's the last thing on swing voters' minds. And so there's a real sense now that it's, you know, by the Cook Political Report and other electoral forecasters and assessments, a 50-50 toss up. And the numbers that we're seeing, you know, you don't have to trust each poll.
Right.
As we talk about, Charlie, you just look at the trend lines, the money the Democratic challengers are raising, the amount of states the Democrats have been able to put on the map, the number of opportunities they have compared to 2 months ago, unthinkable, Kansas, Montana. This is really becoming a grim scenario for Republicans in terms of trying to hold seats that they originally thought would be down to maybe four. And now they're looking at 8, 9, 10.
Okay, so let's just walk through this for people who are just now paying attention. The Republicans need to pick up how many seats? Four?
The Republicans need to hold three if Trump stays on. They need to hold four if Biden's president.
Okay, and we assume that, you tell me whether I'm right about this, that probably the Democrats are going to lose a seat in Alabama.
Right. Doug Jones is not likely to retain his seat in Alabama. And the Democrats are also going to spend money and energy on protecting Gary Peters in Michigan. That's looking a lot better than it did at Christmas time. It just is that he might be the only one that they would think would be possibly vulnerable, and that John James, the Republican challenger who ran against Debbie Stabenow in 2018, has been raising good money, and he has, you know, he's a pretty compelling candidate. It's just not good for John James that the president is now attacking Michigan and pretty much writing it off. So there's that. So, yeah, I think the Democrats believe they're only going to lose Doug Jones.
Okay, but the Michigan story is interesting because this is another example how quality of the candidate actually matters, because that really should not normally be in play. A Democratic incumbent in Michigan in a state that does not look friendly to Donald Trump, at least at the moment. But James is a good candidate.
That's right. And he's a veteran. He's African-American Republican, really, you know, he did a great job in 2018, but it was a Democratic year. They elected a Democratic governor. They reelected Stabenow. It was a good year for Democrats. But he's a player in the future of the party, no question. And Gary Peters is a really good guy who stays very local in his profile and doesn't do any, has no national profile, is kind of shy and in the background, and not enough people know him. And I've had people in the congressional delegation tell me that. So Debbie Stabenow really seemed to suck all the oxygen up in the Senate delegation. And Gary Peters needs to really kind of step out and make sure that voters know his accomplishment. So it's not only a combination of a good challenger, but also that Gary Peters had not really probably done. He has not left his constituents behind. It's not one of those cases where he got too big and focused only on a national profile. It's just that he really needs to sort of, you know, invigorate contributions and that kind of thing to stay strong enough. They feel good about his numbers, but you know, they're not taking anything for granted.
So let's talk about the money. You mentioned the money issue. I haven't been paying a tremendous amount of attention. I look at the polls, but Democrats are doing well in the money wars against Republican incumbents.
Much, much better, and much not only outraising Republicans, including Mitch McConnell last quarter. Not that he's going to lose a Senate race in Kentucky. Amy McGrath is, I think, a disastrous candidate. I don't know if I've said that on your podcast before, but I once wrote a column that Mitch McConnell, I believe, made her up because she's so terrible. But she's obviously getting a lot of dough from around the country, from people who are mad at Mitch McConnell. So a lot of incumbents are way behind in fundraising than their challengers, and the challengers are not only outraising them, but they're raising more than Republicans even expected that they could. So that is obviously a sign of energy and very worrisome. Not only to Susan Collins in Maine, Martha McSally in Arizona, Cory Gardner in Colorado, and Tom Tillis in North Carolina, who are in real danger of losing their seats, but to the other people in Iowa, in two Georgia seats, in Kansas, in Montana, into these other places that Democrats are pushing their way into on the map. So the idea that they have all this money to slush around with means that it's really hard for Republicans to defend Kansas, Montana, Iowa, two seats in Georgia, in addition to the four I just mentioned who are endangered. When the Democrats have all these resources and the Republicans, they'll have to spend money in Texas on John Cornyn. There's just too much Democratic energy there. They'll have to spend money on Mitch McConnell. Those are seats they're probably going to win, but how do they hold Kansas if Pompeo doesn't get in before Monday? How do they stop Steve Bullock against Daines in Montana? They're spending tons of money to protect Steve Daines already in Montana, not where they wanted to be in June of 2020.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder how far money goes in Montana, since but it's like 12 electors there, right? I mean, it's everybody knows everybody.
But think how much money, Charlie, they're going to have to spend on Georgia. The Kelly Loeffler seat, the Johnny Isaacson seat that's in a special, and then David Perdue.
This is very, very unusual that you have two Senate seats in the same state. That almost never happens. So the Georgia, if Georgia were to slip away from the Republicans, that would be just disastrous.
Yes, I mean, and Georgia is truly, truly a swing state now. There's no more, the forecasters are telling us this. It's not a debate. Georgia Republicans are telling us this, that up and down the ballot, Democrats are competitive and that their pants are on fire in the Georgia Republican Party.
Tell me a little bit about Amy McGrath, by the way. You said she was a disaster. What makes you say that?
She's just made all these mistakes. She sort of went back and forth on Brett Kavanaugh. Yeah, it started a long time ago, but right. she
A1.
She has really, she's like got really politically tone deaf. And she, there's a bunch of anecdotes from the start. She sort of put them in the rearview mirror now. She's got made all her mistakes more than 8 months ago, but it was, it really showed that she, and she wasn't a great candidate, by the way, in the congressional race when she ran against, I believe it was Barr. Is it Andy Barr in Kentucky 6? Anyway, know, in the midterm seat that she lost, she didn't run a great campaign. She just became the most sort of, you know, well-known. She's a great story, right? She's a veteran and she's a mom. And so she seems on paper like a great candidate, right, a woman. But there's a real there's a real struggle in Kentucky right now. There's some asparagus farmer that people want, you know, to put up against McGrath. I mean, they're really kind of, she's been Schumer's pick without being official from the start. She's raised a ton of money, but Democrats are worried about her.
Yeah, this is one of these races that we have every year where national Democrats fall in love with somebody, even though on the ground people are going, you know, this is not the best candidate. Beto O'Rourke, you know, obviously overperformed, but when you think about the amount of money that he raised, how much of it came from outside, we've had instances in Wisconsin where national Democrats, the Hollywood folks, fall in love with a candidate that if you'd actually made a phone call to somebody in the state, they go, no, this is a complete train wreck. don't do that. So maybe she's the one who will get all sorts of money and media hype and will fall short. Okay, let's go look at this map because this is extraordinary. And you've gone through some of the states, North Carolina, Colorado, Maine, and Arizona. The Democrats are in real trouble in all of those states. Cory Gardner, Tillis, Collins, Martha McSally. I mean, they are really in deep trouble at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, if you're Republicans, you have to leave McSally for dead. Mark Kelly's really consistently ahead. So is John Hickenlooper in Colorado, between 10 and 18 points in every poll. North Carolina's closer, but Cal Cunningham is a wonderful recruit for the Democrats, a veteran, a measured, not partisan Democrat who's really talking all the right way. And Tillis once booed at a Trump rally because people there think he's a rhino, is really in the fight of his life. And then, you know, Susan Collins in Maine. So I would put Susan Collins as probably on safest ground of the four of them, Tillis right behind her, and then Colorado and Arizona, I think, are gone. So it's going to be a question, right, of kind of triage and where they decide what's more important. You know, keep David Perdue alive in Georgia, keep Ernst alive in Iowa, Steve Daines in Montana, and the Kansas situation, which we have to remind people, by June 1, by Monday, if Mitch McConnell can't convince Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to become the candidate, I mean, to run in the primary against Kris Kobach, they'll end up with Kris Kobach, who is a controversial figure for many reasons.
To put it mildly.
One's going to be like Trump's, you know, immigration czar, but was on his ill-fated voter fraud commission in 2017 that came up with nothing. He ran for governor in the midterms, lost to Laura Kelly, a Democrat. There's now a Democratic governor of Kansas. Who, if Brenda Beaulieu, maybe it's Barbara Beaulieu, forgive me, the Democratic candidate, gets to run against Kris Kobach, is in good shape to win that race. She was a Republican until a year and a half ago. So she's perfect for the state, a perfect recruit for the Democrats. And so Mitch McConnell, it's an open secret in Washington that Mitch McConnell has been begging Mike Pompeo to leave his job and run against Kobach in the primary because they believe he's the only one that can beat him. Interestingly enough, as we've all seen, there's been a different horrifying oppo hit out on Pompeo every 36 hours for the last week and a half. And I doubt he's going to get in on Monday. So they do have to spend a lot of money in Kansas in that case.
This Kris Kobach story, also, again, the flip side of what we talked about in Michigan, that a bad candidate matters as well. And Republicans have a long history of blowing unlosable races by having terrible candidates. Whether you want to go back to Sharon Engel or the woman who said she wasn't a witch, was that Christine O'Donnell?
Christine O'Donnell, Richard Murdoch in Indiana.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of these, or of course, what happened in Alabama and Kris Kobach seems like a sort of a flashback to all of that. And everybody, at least I think objectively speaking, recognizes, you know, that he may be one of the few Republicans who could blow that seat. And the fact that he blew the governor's race just 2 years ago, it's like, how do you think this is a good idea, Republicans?
But this, as we mourn so often, is a direct result of the death of the parties. And because our parties are on life support and don't raise the significant money and can no longer pick candidates, it's the Wild West. And you end up with these people because you can't block the zany ones from winning the primary.
So we already talked about Montana, which again is another one of those seats that a year ago people would not have thought would be in play, but very much is in play because Steve Bullock is a very successful and popular governor, as far as I can tell, and an effective governor in a state that is deep red and yet manages to be elected. And the Democrats really sort of this was the best possible recruit, and they got him.
Right. I mean, he won in 2016 when Donald Trump won the state by, I believe, 20 points. So he's got that. And then in addition, in the COVID crisis, he's enjoyed high approval ratings as well in his leadership through the last couple of months in the crisis. And that's another thing that's interesting in North Carolina, Charlie, because the Democratic governor there, Roy Cooper, is also enjoying improved approval ratings in the pandemic while President Trump is threatening to pull the Republican National Convention out of Charlotte, making Tom Tillis have to choose between what his constituents believe, which is that their governor has done a good job in the response, and Trump trying to play some dumb game and throw a swing state over the cliff. So it's beyond crazy, but yeah, Steve Bullock is just, he really, really resisted running in Montana. He said so many times he only wanted to run for president that when he pulled out of the race, he repeated that he would not run for Senate. No. He looks like a real threat to Steve Daines, for sure. Obviously, the whole state probably knows him better than they know Steve Daines.
So the president's attacks on swing states like Michigan and North Carolina, I think maybe you and I just don't appreciate the subtlety of that.
The cleverness
of that. Okay, let's talk about Veeps for a minute. You probably have heard about this this Politico interview with Stan Greenberg, the famed pollster who popularized the term Reagan Democrats at one time, was very, very big in the Clinton era, is now saying that Senator Elizabeth Warren is the obvious solution, and that if Biden picks Warren as the VP, it would lead to victory. I haven't gone through his whole logic there. Your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is wrong, and I understand when I go through the menu of choices for Joe Biden for a vice presidential nominee, that every single one of them has big problems. There is no silver bullet on the menu. But, we're looking at this, the argument that the Republicans have given up on in the age of Trump, which is mobilization versus persuasion. He's only mobilized and mow everyone else down. He doesn't want a voter he doesn't already have. And Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are grappling with the fact that in an effort to unite to beat President Trump, they decided to pick Joe Biden as their nominee, even progressives, because they want so badly to beat President Trump, but they still want what they want. But are the progressives a majority of the party? Not really. And so there's this, debate that's been going on since voting started in Iowa and all through Biden's sweep and into today, as they look at his VP pick, about whether or not he can win by winning voters in the Midwest who have turned on Trump, were never with Trump, but didn't vote for Hillary, or voted for Obama, then Trump, whatever. You know, this is the persuasion argument, or whether or not he must mobilize a new population of non-voters, young African-American voters who don't like him, and progressives, you know, who want AOC's agenda, and Elizabeth Warren supporters. So I think that the idea that you choose Elizabeth Warren to mobilize progressives and that is a slam dunk to victory is flawed, because there are going to be voters in the Midwest who say, if she's going to be president in 2 years, I can't endorse this. And a lot of people are going to be looking at his pick as the next president. So I think it's really high risk, and I don't think it's enough reward.
So right now, who's rising and falling in your Veep stakes?
Well, I was for Whitmer, as I think I've told you before, because I think a governor in a crisis who's been tested, plus the Midwest, plus women, or I guess they all have to be women, you know, met the most criteria. I mean, for Biden, his brand is able, capable, ready, right? He's just not going to pick someone who can't do it, or who seems to the public, you know, who would give them jitters in a pandemic as untested. So her stock has fallen because, you know, not because of her response to the pandemic, but I guess her husband blew it this weekend when
it was awkward.
He was going to their second home to rake leaves. I don't know how much that will stick, but doesn't look good this morning. And there's a sense among Democrats that you can't take her away from Michigan in the middle of the crisis. She doesn't have to leave Zoom, so I don't really understand that. I think she could still be governor while she was sort of Joe Biden's right hand, but I don't know. So I think Kamala Harris is kind of that sweet spot where she looks like she's capable, but she's been an attorney general of California and a senator, and she looks like she's capable to step in if Biden were to keel over before 4 years or take over after 4 years as the nominee of the party or whatever. She does some mobilizing, but not a lot. When you look at how much the Trump campaign is going to try to depress the African-American vote in terms of criminal justice, that is, you know, going to be that's a liability on Kamala's, you know, pros and cons list, if you will. And I know that Stacey Abrams is being vetted. I think that's just to make people happy. I don't think that she's being seriously considered at all. I know Val Demings is being vetted. I think she probably needs a little more time in office. She was head of the Orlando Police Department, and she's a short-term congresswoman, but it would probably need to be more. Tammy Duckworth reportedly is being vetted. That's a very interesting pick. Certainly has had enough time in the Senate. And I just think that Elizabeth Warren is a mistake, and I'm not looking at the same numbers as pollsters are, and I just know that you'd lose a lot of vote with her if you gained a lot.
So what about Amy? We have a big piece of the bulwark making the case for Amy by Robert.
Yeah, Kucinski. I think that she's she has lost her place in this race because I think that Whitmer is more exciting if she's a governor from more of a swing state, even though Michigan's looking really bad for Trump right now. Amy Klobuchar has also going to have some criminal justice issues. I personally think that she would be a good pick. I just don't know that you can make the case to Biden that he should pick her. There's a lot of African-American pressure in the party right now to not pick Amy Klobuchar.
No, I've seen this. So does the overhyped gaffe, and I think it was cringeworthy and it was stupid. But when I say overhyped, I mean that it dominated the news cycle for a day when Biden said, you know, you ain't black if you don't vote for him. I mean, what is I say it's overhyped is, and that's not a defense of him, but you contrast that to the next 50, you know, gaffes and outrages from Donald Trump. This is part of the asymmetry of this campaign that Joe Biden is treated like a normal human being, who needs to be held accountable for his stupidity. But there's nothing normal about Trump. So it's almost like there's a completely different standard for Trump. You know, he will have 10 things worse than that in the next hour. But the media feels compelled now to spend an entire day, weekend, talking about the latest stupid thing that Joe Biden said.
But that hurt him. It would have gone on. They had a new website. They made up T-shirts. They started doing streaming online Trump shows about it to excite their supporters. It was the best thing that happened to the campaign in months, the Trump campaign. Yes. And then he went in all in on Joe Scarborough again. So yeah, he actually got it. He took it right out of the headlines.
See, you just don't appreciate, you don't appreciate the subtlety of that.
I know. So true, the cleverness. So it's true. I think that Biden made a huge mistake. I think it was very painful for Democrats, more than they're willing to say out loud. You know, Jim Clyburn, Congressman of South Carolina, who has basically championed Biden through his first and several subsequent victories and is really being credited with turning his campaign around, said that he cringed. It was really a stupid and arguably racist thing to say. I think that it's a reminder that Joe Biden has a hot head like President Trump. The degree is nowhere near the level, the hot lava level of President Trump. But Obama doesn't act this way. You know, Hillary doesn't act that way. That you can tick him off, you can make him defensive, and he reacts emotionally and he loses control.
Well, see, now this is the danger. Let's go back to the Rush Limbaugh thing, you know, where he's describing what Trump is doing, that Trump likes to throw out things, whether they're true or not, with the goal of lighting the fire, of triggering a response. So in a lot of ways, you know, we know that what Trump has done, the whole Hunter Biden thing, I think the real maliciousness is that he knows that Joe Biden's family is a deeply emotional, vulnerable point for him. And so he has zeroed in on that. So, you know, this will be the strategy to throw stuff, try to get under his skin, to make him trigger some sort of a reaction. And unfortunately, you know, as you point out, Biden is triggerable.
Right. I think that Biden has somehow been able to compartmentalize Trump and attacks from Trump. I agree. His family makes him emotional, and attacks on Hunter Biden, who is very unstable and very troubled and still struggles enormously as we speak, is really, really very difficult territory for Joe Biden. But I think that he has managed, if you watched that CNN interview the other day, and the way that he was on the stump this whole season of campaigning, always when he was talking about Trump, he was at his most composed, most confident, most lucid, most articulate. But when he feels defensive about different parts of the Democratic coalition is when he stumbles. When he feels that he is not progressive enough, not young enough, not updated enough, not upgraded enough, he loses his cool. And so I'm not saying he wouldn't have a moment like you are describing, a potential moment in a debate or something. His family, Trump might succeed at that. But I found him when he was talking the other day about Trump, that he's on his surest footing, it seems, at least sort of rhetorically, when he's describing Trump's attacks on him. And I thought they were very effective in that interview. And so we'll see. But I think it's a reminder for the people around him that they really have to be careful about him being triggered by a defense of his record. And he'll often say things that aren't true. And he gets really loud and grouchy. And it probably happened early enough in the campaign that it could, on balance, help him more than hurt him. However, it will be a huge gift in the Facebook digital landscape for Trump all the way to Election Day in his effort to depress African-American vote. There's no question.
No. And, you know, the one thing I want to say something positive about Joe Biden here. If Donald Trump's superpower is his shamelessness, I think that Joe Biden's superpower is his empathy, which seems real and genuine to me. And he may be clueless about a variety of things. He may be wrong on a lot of the issues. You know, I cringe when I see various things about him talking about he's going to, you know, put an end to charter schools. What's with that? Or he's weighing in on this California, you know, part-time freelancer rule, which I don't think he understands how it's playing out in the real world. Like, well, just why are you getting involved in that? Do you really actually understand what you're talking about? But there is a sense of humanity. But it is, you mentioned the sort of Facebook video world. They have just pounded away on this idea of sleepy Joe Biden, and they have edited his videos to make it sound like he cannot put together a sentence. By November, you will have half the country believing that he's basically senile. There's a risk to that, of course, is that if he comes out and sounds reasonably lucid with a sense of humor about it, it blows up in your face. It's sort of like, you know, going after Ronald Reagan for being too old, and, you know, I'm saying, there you go again. So it is going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because they've gone all in on the cognitive decline, sleepy Joe stuff.
Yes, and it was so interesting watching him respond to that, because when Dana Bash of CNN said, they are making the case that you are missing a step, how do you respond to that? And he really kept his cool, and he said, look, I think the president, and he sort of said it slowly to make sure that he said the right thing. He said he seems like he's not in control of his emotions right now. And he seems increasingly erratic as he perceives more and more that he's behind the curve, that he's behind in the polls. And it's true. It's like, you know, when you listen to Joe Biden articulately describe that he believes when he does something wrong, he should apologize, like his "you ain't black" comment and why that was the wrong thing. And so, of course, I apologize, because I'm trying out for the job of president, and I wear a mask because that's what a president should be doing in a pandemic. And then you have, you know, you compare it to the way that that Trump is tweeting or talking or acting. And it is a terrible contrast for Trump, because all you have to do is talk about, you know, Lysol enemas or Joe Scarborough, and you bring it right on back to, you know, is Joe Biden's capability and competence really the issue here?
A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. We always appreciate it.
Terrific to be with you, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.